Hi, Grace Tame here. You might know me as the 2021 Australian of the Year or quote unquote difficult woman, but did you know I'm also autistic? It took me a long time to get diagnosed, and sadly, that's true for a lot of women. I want to know why that's the case. That's why I'm taking over Ladies We Need to Talk for a series called Autistic AF. Find it by searching Ladies We Need to Talk on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the blood starts flying, I'll do business with the devil himself. Victory at all costs. Well, that's the only thing. Ah, you can discuss the moral ethics as we bury the enemy. Now, Lee, that's no war general. That is actually Mark Brandon Reed, better known as Chopper.
That voice rings a bell, but the words aren't exactly the Chopper I would imagine. When I imagine Chopper, he's like a bogan involved in a bit of a TV scandal or something.
Absolutely. Look, and I think that that is the way that most people think of him. Chopper Reed, you know, he was a murderer, a mainstay in Melbourne's criminal underworld, and a pop culture icon of sorts. He's spoken about really as being sort of both feared and beloved.
That's an odd combo if you ask me.
But who was Chopper? And did he trick us all into seeing him as something that he wasn't? This is The Dead Can't Sue. I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher.
And we're back in the studio to gossip this week about the infamous Chopper Reed. I went on quite a ride diving into the life of Mark Brandon Reed for this two-parter, so I want to take you along the journey. There'll be bolt cutters, blow torches, and scissor attacks, and that's not including the violence that Chopper experienced himself. Okay, so consider this your content warning.
Right, I think I'm ready.
On his deathbed in 2013, he confessed to four murders that he'd gotten away with over his lengthy criminal career. Four was actually a lot less than the original 19 murders that he'd claimed to have committed in his 1991 book.
I gotta say, I'm pretty skeptical of this bloke and the various claims he seems to be making.
Fair.
I've got a kind of recollection that he engaged in almost like a public relations campaign to rehabilitate his image towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
What was going on?
Yeah, look, you're right, Lee. There was the author, the comic, the artist. There was also Chopper the family man. Uh-huh. You know, like the very last image that we actually have of Chopper, which is this 60 Minutes interview, out he comes with his wife, his kid. They all hug.
It's a fair way away from scissors down the back of someone's neck. I'm having trouble putting those things together.
Look, and I don't want to give too much away, but even that image, not true.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So looking closely at his life, I realized that basically this is someone who reinvents himself over and over again. And moving from Chopper to us as a nation, I think that he tells us something really interesting about our changing national values. And I found myself when I was researching this thinking, okay, would Chopper, this avowedly racist, homophobic, violently transphobic, domestically abusive, violent man, would he be pitched as a beloved local character today?
He sounds like he belongs in the manosphere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. Yeah. Like, he would exist in some dark, grubby corner of the internet, and he would be amply critiqued by a population who are now very literate in the language of toxic masculinity. And I think Chopper Reed as a historical figure tells us something really interesting about the 1990s and 2000s.
Well, that's when I was growing up, so I'm looking forward to talking about my own teenage years with ABC's audience.
So in Chopper's biography, he wrote, and I quote, "Look, I know it's popular these days to talk about all the abuse that you got as a child, but personally, I'd rather keep the worst part to myself."
Okay, Alicia, I think you might have been listening to a little bit too much Chopper audio, but let's just go with that accent
really
for now.
I nailed it, Lee. Anyway, I feel like I'm channeling Chopper.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Maybe you're frightened by that, by yeah. the, yes,
I'm
the
quaking very similitude. In my boots.
Look, I mean, the thing is, and I don't want to make light at all of his violent childhood, but that's what you need to do to kind of to understand him. So I do want to go back there to his childhood. So, basic facts. Mark Brandon Reed, born in 1954. His father's a distressed World War II vet. And his mother, and I think this is really significant, is a devout Seventh-day Adventist. At a time when that is considered to be very weird. Remember, Lindy Chamberlain is a Seventh-day Adventist.
It's almost, they have an almost cult-like status,
don't
they?
And the crucial part, I think, which makes us go paging Dr. Freud, is that he spent his first 18 months in a Methodist baby's home. Basically, his mother falls pregnant almost as soon as he was born, and she couldn't really cope with two babies at once, so he gets shunted off. Yep. So imagine, let's think about Chopper. There he is, first 18 months of his life, no mum and dad. Instead, you've got a sir and a madam. And the building itself, you can imagine a grim and austere kind of monolith of a building, long light-striped corridors, iron cots, linoleum floors. So 18 months there. Then he lives with his parents until their relationship falters and his father actually spends the weekdays at the army barracks and only seeing Mark on weekends, and that's until 1967.
So what's happening to him at school?
Yeah, look, you can probably guess he's not great at school. Later, when he's in an institution, he's diagnosed with partial autism. You know, he has a real problem focusing and with processing sensory input, basically. It all kind of merges for him. So he's mercilessly bullied, probably for that. He's a huge kid as well. He's kind of oversized and he's bullied for being a Seventh-day Adventist. As we said before, they're a bit of a cult. It also means he can't participate in Saturday sport.
Way to alienate yourself from an Australian state school.
Right, absolutely. So he's constantly expelled and he runs away from home a lot, particularly between the ages of 10 and 15.
That's so young.
Yeah.
That's so young, you know, or at least it feels so young to me, running away from, like when I ran away from home at 11, like I packed my teddy bear. You know, it wasn't
totally.
It wasn't really running away from home. This guy's running away from home. So what in his life means at 11, he's trying to get out of his house.
I packed pikelets, by the way. and some Jane Austen.
I was going fishing.
Cute. Okay, so let's imagine his home life. You know, it's not great. That said, it's not your usual criminal story. So often with criminal stories, it's like, oh, he came from a criminal family, this kind of thing. And this is what a lot of people say. They say, well, you know, how did he become Chopper, given that his parents were very upstanding, his father was a soldier, mother Seventh-day Adventist, surely not that bad. The houses themselves are not that bad at all. In fact, he moves between the Mornington Peninsula, Thomastown and South Yarra, and all of those homes are very nice. In fact, the last school that he gets expelled from is a private school.
Okay.
So, you know, we're not talking about poverty here. What we're talking about is a lack of familial warmth and love within them. So let me paint a picture of that for you, Lee. So Chopper says that his father, for instance, would sleep with a pump-action rifle beside his bed.
This is a little boy growing up with the spectre of kind of violence,
yeah.
I guess.
And not just the spectre of violence, can I say violence actually as well? Because his mother offers absolutely no solace. So she's a religious zealot. She's also a disciplinarian. And she gets his father to beat him. And I think there's a wonderful biography about Chopper by Adam Shand. So this is what his biographer Adam Shand said. With a word from her, Keith, his dad, would give his son terrible beatings. He'd take his belt off and thrash the kid until he was black and blue. And his mother would just watch, impassive, cold and uncaring, as if God had decreed that such punishments were just. And this is how Chopper himself puts it in his memoir. He says, look, I just didn't feel loved as a kid, and I grew up praying to God that he would kill my mother.
Okay, we just need to pause for a second here. His dad's beating the crapper out of him, but he's blaming his mum.
Yeah.
And he still loves his dad. Like, I think, you know, he's kind of still admiring his father. There is some messed up stuff going on here. We actually do need to page Dr. Freud, I think. Like, I think that much is clear.
Where is he when you need him?
I think it's time to get Chopper on the couch.
Can I say the other thing? His dad's barely there. Remember, his dad's actually sleeping at the barracks entire time. So I just feel like there needs to be not a trigger warning, but a fiction warning, you know, that goes off with so many of these moments that Chopper narrates. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt that there was violence in his upbringing. Whether it's all his mother's fault, I sense a possible, you know, misogyny.
Yeah, so what we might say then is he clearly had a complicated family dynamic. It clearly was what we would probably call dysfunctional.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
So tell me, how does he get this name Chopper?
The name Chopper does not come, as we all imagine, from him either chopping off his ears, chopping off other people's toes. There's a lot in the life of a criminal that could give you a nickname like Chopper.
Or chopping off the wings of an insect. I was imagining some slightly psychotic child torturing insects.
The sociopath kind of origins of Chopper. Look, the origins of it are actually that there was a cartoon called Yakky Doodle that was around in the 1960s, and Yakky Doodle had a really naughty little bird in it that was constantly getting into trouble, and then it had a bulldog called Chopper, and Chopper would protect the bird. And so he got the nickname actually from his dad.
Do you believe it? Do you believe that story? Given what we're saying about his self-reinvention, and we've just been talking about his idealisation of his father.
I actually do believe it, because I think the alternative is that it is given to him by people in the criminal underworld who are terrified of him because he is always chopping them up. And I think, as we'll learn later, a lot of the people in the criminal underworld say, we didn't actually know who he was.
Yeah, sure.
You know? So, look, other than that, I'd say Chopper as a kid is, and I think Adam Shand puts it really well. He says, look, he's intelligent. There's no doubt about it. He's personable. He wants to be liked. He's got an amazing, astonishing memory. But in class, he really struggles with distractions. He becomes agitated, disruptive, leading to anxiety and aggression. Okay, so basically he's placed then at the age of 14 in a series of institutions. And while there, and I should have a ding, 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 because we don't know whether this is true, but he says he received 60 electroconvulsive shock therapy treatments as well as deep sleep therapy.
It just feels like a classic story that we tell about the 60s. You know, we tell the story of the pre-enlightened 70s institutions and psychiatrists lobotomizing patients, putting them into deep sleep therapy, giving them electroshock therapy, all of which was actually happening in a variety of ways, particularly with vulnerable populations. Like, vulnerable populations in institutions, their bodies were incredibly subject to the whims of psychiatrists trying to figure out experimental treatments. But I wonder if that happened to Chopper, or Chopper's grabbing hold of that story.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, when you interview people who worked at that institution where he was in Melbourne, they say it would be very unlikely for a 14-year-old to receive 60 electroshock therapy treatments. That just wasn't on the books at that stage.
In six months, right? Yeah.
That said, you know, let's not underplay how hard it would have been. He is still there. We know that he's definitely there in various institutions. So I just want to picture little chop, age between, you know, 15 and 20. He's young. And there he is. He goes into this institution that is a red brick mock Tudor monolith, built in the 1930s, 40-bed dormitories, no privacy, smoke-choked lounge rooms, blaring televisions, and inside you hear everyone from hardened criminals, schizophrenics, depressed or unruly housewives. He actually describes it in his memoir. It was terrifying as a teenager to be placed in a ward with grown men strapped to their beds. The noise was unbelievable. And, you know, Lee, I don't think it matters really whether it is true that he got the electroshock therapy treatments. We know that other people did, entirely against their will. We also know that victims should be believed.
There's also a larger historical truth here, which he's trying to convince us about. He's a vulnerable young man of 15 in an adult institution of scary men, and that institution is pretty hostile to him.
It is hostile, though he does say in his memoirs he makes friends. And I think there's something else that we need to pick up from this moment, which is when you're in a psychiatric institution, you have a lot of time to sit around with a bunch of strangers and talk about yourself and to start hearing other people talk about themselves. So if we come to think about Chopper as someone who's very good at self-narration, at self-invention, then I think we talk about the institution not just as a place that hardened him, but also as a place that began to make him the great raconteur that he came to be.
Okay, Alicia, let's get out of the ward. Let's get me to some of these meaty crimes.
Okay. He drops out of school, does a range of odd jobs, is predictably fired from all of them. And his diary, randomly, he says that the Rhodesian military are recruiting at that time. That's the white nationalist state that later becomes Zimbabwe. But he's even rejected from them. He says it's for being flat-footed.
So just hold up. He gets rejected by desperate white nationalists.
My poor Chopper.
Poor Chopper.
God. No wonder he turns to crime.
Yeah.
Look, Andrew Rule, one of the two editors of his memoir, says at this moment where he's rejected, because also imagine he's growing up with his father, the hero father is the soldier. This is his chance to find the war. Mm. You know, he's excited about this and he gets rejected. You know, Andrew Rule has this lovely line where he says, Chopper was a soldier in search of a war that he never found.
Oh, wow.
And I think that that's just such a great line. But basically he says, look, this was the fork in the road and he turned the wrong way. So, yeah.
So he spent his life imagining following in his father's footsteps. The moment arrives where he gets the chance.
Yeah.
Fails the test.
Absolutely. So instead he starts hanging out at a local youth club. He learns boxing, wrestling, develops a reputation as a heavyweight boxer, street fighter. Not that he's a particularly good one. Apparently he's just fearless of the consequences. Mm. And that comes to characterise him throughout his life. At this youth club, it's called the Tri Boys Youth Club, he meets some other misfits and school dropouts, and he claims, ding, 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 he claims in his diary that this is where he forms the Surrey Road Gang. So,
it's a lovely, polite name for a gang.
Isn't it, coming from Sydney where... Surrey Hills is kind of posh.
Yeah.
Look, it's a criminal gang, he says, of four boys who make the mafia, in his words, look like pansies.
Oh, that's an insult we don't hear enough
exactly.
these days.
he says, look, and I'm quoting from him, we had a collection of iron bars, knives, sawn-off shotguns, .22 caliber rifles, tomahawks, meat cleavers. We were a young but violently advanced crew. We would engage larger gangs in combat with our World War I issue Australian Army bayonets, and we were undefeated. If you betray a gang member in this Surrey Road gang, your punishment is to get shot in both legs. But guess what, Lee? Adam Shand said, none of this is true.
I was about to go ding, 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 ding. because those words of Choppers, they were feeling basically a little bit like a World War One comic mixed with a crime novel.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's him fabulating and inventing a group of friends who he never had. You know, he's a misfit and he's lying and imagining this world that never exists to cover his loneliness. And I think we can see this in photos of him at the time. Chopper is, in his own words, an 18-stone giant. He's a huge kid with a thick mop of black hair, dark eyes, and a smile that I think, at least in this photo of him, which I've seen in the memoir at this time, he looks both awkward and menacing. It's so, this strange kind of combination of vulnerability and aggression.
I need to ask a question.
Do.
How heavy is 18 stone in kilograms?
It's 114 kilos.
Okay.
Okay, so the first crime on his rap sheet occurs in May 1971. He's 16 when he breaks into the gay club where he's working as a bouncer. It should have actually been a probationary offence, but his father came to court carrying a note written by his mother saying, and this is going to wound, she says that she will not take him back home. So, I know. So he's instead placed in Tirana's boys' home and he's made a ward of the state. And it's his last time there. The next offence, he goes to Pentridge.
Yeah, okay.
So in December of the same year, he's sent to prison for beating up some bouncers who happened to be off-duty police officers.
Oops.
I know. So for that, he's given 2 months. The magistrate notes that he has no remorse. So it's his first time in Pentridge. From what I can see, it's pretty brutal and brutalising work. So if he's in H block, which is the solitary ward, your work each day involves smashing rocks into the size of marbles. And when not working, prison gangs conduct war on each other.
When I got my marble set in 1979, had it been made at Pentridge? Is that what you're telling me?
They're the size of marbles.
Right, sure, sorry.
What is actually interesting with that, Lee, is that marble set that you got would have gone along roads that were made in Pentridge.
Right.
So what they're doing is they're smashing up rocks to create the gravel that then becomes the roads of Melbourne.
Yeah, okay.
So he's eventually released from prison. He goes to live then with his father in South Yarra. By this time, his parents are divorced.
Hold up, Alicia. The chopper I know is on the mean streets of Collingwood, Fitzroy, when it's all a bit grimy. What's he doing in South Yarra?
I know. I mean, towards the end of his life, Chopper made a big deal about the fact that he lived in Collingwood, Fitzroy. And in his memoir as well, he says, the gangs that I were in were all around Collingwood and Fitzroy. And what we've got to remember is that Collingwood and Fitzroy are not the oat latte sipping suburbs that they are today. They were impoverished inner city slum areas with a growing migrant population and a very high crime rate. The reason why Chopper pretends that he's there rather than in posh South Yarra or Mornington Peninsula is that he's wanting to sell us this myth of Chopper.
Yeah,
and Chopper needs an appropriate backdrop.
Okay, how does he go in South Yarra?
Look, it's 1972 and he's pretty out of control. His biographer says that his friends avoid him, saying that he always just wants to pick fights. In this time, he becomes, or so he says, a standover man. Another word for that is a headhunter.
Hey, hold on.
Yeah.
I was headhunted for the ABC. I don't think I quite know what that term means.
So a headhunter or a standover man, same thing. They're a criminal who makes a living through robbing other criminals. So in his case, it's drug dealers and brothel owners. The idea behind it is that, firstly, you know that person is going to have a huge stash of money, which is the case with drug dealers or brothel owners. Illegal gambling dens are one of his other favourite haunts. Secondly, they can't complain about it to authorities because what they're doing is illegal. So you can imagine the extent to which that makes him hated amongst the criminal underworld. The other thing that it does that I think is interesting is that it gives him a moral gloss to his violence. Here is a guy who, in his own words, is a human garbage disposal unit. He's cleaning up the streets.
So this is interesting. He's breaking the moral code of the criminal underclass that he's in?
Not for the first time, Lee, and it won't be the last time.
Right.
You know, the very fact that he writes about it.
And then writes about it. And
code tells, of silence.
Tells a story about it to the outside world that's going to make the outside world like him.
Exactly. He breaks those two fundamental codes of the criminal underworld. The first one is the code of silence, and that's what he does when he starts to write about them. And the second one is he preys on his own. So you're absolutely right. The thing with that is that it gives him a moral gloss for his violence, and a theme that I think we will continue to see on this episode, which is a two-part episode, is that Chopper is pro-establishment.
Okay.
I know it's not something that we imagine for a criminal.
How very Melbourne.
Exactly. So grid-like. Okay, so it's the 1970s. He's in and out of prison, in and out of boys' homes a few times. But there's one time that I really want to tell you about, which is in 1978. And in this moment, it's completely mad. He's sentenced to prison again, this time for staging a crime that was, and I quote, so supremely stupid that no one could possibly have made it up. That's his biographer, Adam Shand. In full view of a sitting courtroom, he tried to kidnap a county court judge.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. He walks up to Judge Bill Martin. He puts an unloaded, sawn-off shotgun to his throat. What does the judge do? Well, he kicked him in the genitalia. His associate, with 25 years in the military behind him, jammed him into a doorframe, and he was arrested by police who had been sitting in the back of the court.
Look, I've got to say, I'm a little bit impressed with the physical prowess of our judiciary.
So
I don't normally think about them as, like, getting down and dirty on the streets, but, you know, this judge is holding his own, so is his associate. But tell me, why on earth did he decide, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go stick a shotgun in a judge's mouth. Like, talk me through his logic.
Look, as always with Chopper, we have to explain what he says and what we think is the true story.
Yeah, sure.
So what Chopper says is that his plan was to hold the judge hostage to demand the release of his best mate, Jimmy Loughnan. So Jimmy Loughnan is in J Ward in Ararat, where the real criminally insane are held. And Chopper thinks, if I can kidnap this judge, hold a gun to his head without him kicking me in the genitals, and his associate with extraordinary military powers, you know, kind of bundling him up against the wall. Ideally, that would not have happened, and he would have then said, release my friend, and that's what would have happened.
So once again, bit like the Rhodesian military, best laid plans have gone to waste.
Yeah, exactly.
He's gone to a big daddy father figure, and the daddy father figure's given him a slap.
Exactly. But he goes to an even bigger daddy father figure, which is Pentridge.
Yeah, sure.
And I actually came to think that all of these times that Chopper does these crazy acts, it's because he wants to go to jail.
Yeah.
I actually think he's really comfortable because of his upbringing in institutions.
So even if we don't have to think that he loved institutions, we can probably say he doesn't know how to be outside of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's inculcated into them.
Yeah.
And with Chopper Lee, I think we can actually quote him as loving institutions.
Yeah, okay.
There are actually interviews where he said, I love Pentridge. I loved H Ward. Love solitary.
Yeah, okay.
So super interesting. But I think the other thing that's going on here is Chopper has a very fertile inner world that is nourished, I think, and watered with literature. So Chopper has read a whole series of books whilst in Pentridge, and he loves this vision of a world of blood loyalties,
yeah, okay,
of kind of almost medieval loyalties and betrayals. So that's
a little bit too much Shakespeare, not enough Dickens.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
He hasn't hit the modern period. And a good example of that world of blood loyalties is actually another crazy chopper story. So it's 1978. He's been sentenced to prison, and his friend, Amos Atkinson, holds 30 people hostage at a restaurant to demand Chopper's release.
So, wait. They hadn't learned from the Bill Martin episode that taking hostages doesn't work?
No. So many. Exactly. Look, the siege actually only ends when Amos's mum, acting as a go-between, marches into the restaurant in her dressing gown, hits her son over the head with her handbag, telling him, "Ah, will you stop being so stupid, Amos?"
Look, I'm not going to lie. There's a few moments in my life I wish mum had come into the room and sort of set me on the right track.
Handbag in tow.
Chopper, you know, I'm sort of calculating. I've got basically a little table here of who is killing, who is hitting, who is meting out violence to. And he, you mentioned he's got this code, this story, which is, "I'm the garbage disposal unit. I only kill bad guys."
Absolutely.
Is that true?
So the way he puts it, he says, "None of the people I have killed were innocent, normal, or average 9-to-5 working types." Okay, so they are the grievable lives in our world. He says the people he kills, and I quote him, were drug dealers, hoons, pimps, crime figures, and killers. Some of them have killed plenty in the drug world with a needle. And he actually says, "Strange as it may seem, I've never considered myself to be a murderer because they all had it coming. Most of them came under the heading of technical necessities. All of them were killers and violent crims. So you know what? Big deal." That's what he says.
This is someone who's read a little bit too much Shakespeare. And maybe he's kind of casting himself as a moral arbiter over who gets to live, who gets to die. "I'm a good guy because I only kill bad guys."
Yeah. But in 1974, he is given a 2-year sentence for trespassing and stealing when he breaks into a massage parlour. And who does he steal money from? Not from the owners of the massage parlour, but from the female workers.
Yeah, okay.
And similarly to the judge. He's hardly, you know, the filth of society. So
he's no Robin Hood.
He's no Robin Hood, but you know what? He wants to be a Robin Hood.
Yeah, okay.
And he knows, we're getting all this from his book, and he knows, having read a bunch of books in Pentridge, that what we like is not a crim. What we like is a heroic crim.
Yeah, okay.
Like we need them to have some kind of moral justification for what they're doing. And
so
that's
he's casting himself
up
as a kind of Ned Kelly for the modern world. But my question to you, Alicia, isn't a question about the story he tells, but it's a question about the story we tell, which is, we've talked about institutions, we've talked about violence. He clearly becomes a violent human. Do you have a working theory on, you know, what created not the chopper of his own imaginary, but the chopper who robbed that sex worker, who shoved the knife down the throat, who saw violence as a way of life?
I think it's a really interesting question, Lee. I think that Chopper is made, not born.
Yep.
And I think he is made firstly by what we call today a version of toxic masculinity. I think that he is made by a father who represents all of the kind of bloodlust and violence of the military. I think he's also made by a mother who, in her religious devotion and in her religious zealotry, teaches him a moral code whereby your primary relationship is not to the state, which is what any socialized person would have, but is to God.
Yeah.
So when he enacts violence on someone, not only does he say in those moments, "I was going into combat, I'm a soldier," he also says, "I'm doing it for God."
Yeah, okay. So you know, literally, it's not simply a religious framing of a moral order that's not bound to the state. It's actually literally he says, I'm doing the work of God.
He says, I'm doing the work of God. He equivocates, though. He also says, oh, sometimes I worry that God's going to judge me. Oh, this bloody religious stuff, it's hard to get rid of it. I was brought up with it. And then he'll say, but you know what? I think I was doing that, and I think I'm owed an apology. I also think that he's created by institutions. I think that not having any parental touch for the first 18 months of your life is probably going to damage you. I think going in and out of institutions is going to damage you.
So there's two figures shaping his early life, religion and the military, and these in combination produce this sort of unique orientation towards the world. But one thing I'm still really perplexed about is how he ends up with no ears.
Okay, look, he's locked up in Pentridge basically from the age of 20 to 38, okay? And in that time, he only spends about 13 months of his life outside of prison. And to find out how he ends up with no ears, but with an oddly successful career as an author, a children's book writer, and a stand-up comic. Tune in next week to the second part of this episode.
Alicia, it's been a joy gossiping about Chopper Reid with you. If you know someone who loves history or gossip, or just, you know, two academics letting loose in an ABC studio, share The Dead Can't Sue with them.
Or if you have a story that you'd like us to tell, send an email to thedeadcan'tsue@abc.net.au.
The Dead Can't Sue is an ABC Audio Studios podcast made on the land of the Kulin Nation and on Gadigal Country.
It's produced by supervising producer Hannah Riche with executive producers Claire Rawlinson and Eric George. Beverly Wang was the development producer and Jessica Radburn is the head of audio on demand. Engineering by Brendan O'Neill. We've chucked a bunch of links to our sources in the show notes, so go on, do some further reading. We dare you.
I'm Lee Boucher, Associate Professor at Macquarie University.
And I'm Alicia Simmons, Associate Professor at UTS.
And we can't wait to gossip about the dead again next week.